Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Forget supply, forget demand. Think about this the next time you fill up the tank. It's entirely possible that traders were driving up oil prices last summer just because they could. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday. It is the 28th of July today. And that would be July of 2009, of course, with the recession firmly upon us and oil struggling to break $70 a barrel. Last year, about this time, you might remember it was a completely different story. Oil at $147, gas at $4 or higher, and much speculation about speculation. Claims that supply and demand alone couldn't possibly be driving crude prices that high. Well, welcome back to Today in Washington. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission is considering new restrictions on speculative trading in oil and some other energy markets. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
During the Bush administration, the free market philosophy ruled. Federal regulators were loath to rein in Wall Street. But with Wall Street in the doghouse and a Democrat in the White House, the mood has changed. Regulators are set to crack down on speculative trading in energy markets. Barbara Shook is an analyst at Energy Intelligence Group. She says for hedge funds and investment banks, buying oil futures is essentially legalized gambling.
They bet on prices going up, and then they start betting the other way for prices to go down. And if they have enough money behind them, they can make markets move.
Shook says it's impossible to know exactly how big a role speculators play in oil price spikes. The sheer volume of energy futures trading is enormous, and much of it takes place in unregulated over-the-counter markets. But airlines and other businesses that depend on stable fuel prices insist speculators make energy markets more volatile. Sean Cota speaks for fuel buyers, including gas stations. He argues if supply and demand were the only factor affecting gas prices, they should be $1 a gallon lower.
At this point in a weak economy, not only is that damaging the retailer who's trying to sell enough gasoline to stay in business, but that money is a tax on consumers.
Regulators may limit the number of futures contracts a trader can hold at one time, but traders warn if the government cracks down too much, it will reduce the number of players in energy markets and hurt liquidity. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Elsewhere on the Washington agenda today, some of the country's biggest loan servicing companies have been summoned to the Capitol. The White House is unhappy with their progress on its Making Home Affordable program. That's the Obama administration's plan to help more than 3 million homeowners modify their mortgages and so stay out of foreclosure. 5 months in, though, just 200,000 families have been helped. Marketplace's Tamara Keith has more.
The gathering seemed like it might be a trip to the woodshed for banks and loan servicers, but it turns out it wasn't all punishment. Barbara DeSoor with Bank of America Home Loans was there and says it was constructive.
We all have the same objective, is the good news, which is to get more customers who want to stay in their homes to be able to do so and to make the process more customer friendly.
Just ask customers, though, and many will tell you this process has been anything but friendly. There's just a lot of confusion around the Making Home Affordable program.
It can be very, very frustrating.
Marietta Rodriguez heads foreclosure prevention efforts at NeighborWorks of America. She says homeowners spend hours on hold and months waiting for answers. Sometimes call center workers give out wrong information. Frequently, Rodriguez says customers and loan counselors are told applications are lost or out of date.
In many cases, we we'll fax it and email it back into that same system, just overloading it again because we don't have a sense. Well, did you get it? I don't know. If I got it, it may be sitting there, and so we'll just send it again. And it's just this very vicious cycle of communication.
Rodriguez says there are some very simple things servicers could do to streamline the process, like keeping customers in the loop on where their applications stand. And servicers talked about some of those things today. The Treasury Department released a statement as the gathering wrapped up, saying that servicers did commit to do more loan modifications more quickly going forward. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Another day, another piece of bad news for the Wall Street bank that everybody loves to hate. That would be Goldman Sachs. Congress is looking into how the firm managed to make so much money while the rest of us were stuck in a recession. The inquiry comes at a challenging time for the bank's public relations staff. You might have heard about a recent article in Rolling Stone magazine that called Goldman a, and I'm quoting here, a vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity. Goldman doesn't exactly cater to small investors, though, so we wondered if it really cares about the bad press. Marketplace's Amy Scott looked into it.
Goldman Sachs made almost $3.5 billion last quarter, so who cares if some reporter calls it a vampire squid?
It truly couldn't care less what we think of it because it doesn't impact its bottom line.
Nomi Prinz wrote the book It Takes a Pillage about the financial bailout. She's also a former managing director at Goldman Sachs. She says Goldman's clients are mostly institutions and very wealthy people. As long as the bank is making them money, she says its reputation with the masses doesn't really matter.
It had a record profit. It's going to give either record or near record bonuses. And as long as the public doesn't really own or dump its stock, which hasn't been the case, there is no impact to its bottom line whatsoever at all.
That could change if the public outcry causes lawmakers and regulators to interfere. A Goldman Sachs spokesman told me the firm does care about what the public thinks. He says the bank has been more proactive lately in addressing what it considers misperceptions about the business. Goldman's reputation on Wall Street is another matter. Gustavo Dolfino runs the financial recruiting firm White Rock Group. He says all the scrutiny could make it more difficult for Goldman to attract top talent.
They just were a part of the excess that went on. And I think it's going to take some time to get back the, you know, the street's respect.
Dolfino says besides, it's likely in the future the pay packages at Goldman Sachs won't be what they used to be. He says the players want to strike out on their own or work for hedge funds or private equity firms where the real money can be made. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I don't usually do this, but Michael Lewis has a great send-up of Goldman in his Bloomberg column today. There is a link on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, Goldman Schmoldman, things were subdued. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Michael Vick is about halfway back to playing professional football after a year and a half in jail for dogfighting. Yesterday, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell conditionally reinstated the former Atlanta Falcons quarterback. That means he'll probably be allowed to play again if he can find a team to sign him. Commentator and sports writer John Wertheim offers some advice.
Just as Michael Vick is likely to learn a new playbook if and when, and I think when, he's offered a job, any NFL franchise considering Vick will do well to consult a new public relations primer. Vick is not the first convicted criminal or controversial player to get a second chance, but this is uncharted territory. No player has ever ignited the firestorm Vick has or committed a crime that's had such a visceral effect on so many. The standard sports crisis management manual is no good. So here is some unsolicited play calling for prospective teams. First, know your market. Just what constitutes an irredeemable act varies from community to community. But surely Vick's dogfighting crimes and cruelty to animals goes over particularly poorly in, say, a small southern NFL market such as Jacksonville or Charlotte. Second, stress time served. Vick spent 18 months in federal prison. He's filed for bankruptcy. He'll even be suspended for the first part of the 2009 season. No one is asking for pity, but a team would do well to make clear that there has been some retribution here. Third, consider playing Vick somewhere other than his usual position of quarterback. The quarterback is unmistakably the team leader in the face of the franchise. Vic is sufficiently athletic that he could be a so-called wildcat back, a versatile player who could run trick plays, return kickoffs, even line up as a defensive back. Doing so, at least initially, would make his return something less of a cause celeb. Fourth, tread lightly. The team that gives the appearance of trying to capitalize on Vic's notoriety will face severe backlash. Resist any urge to sell his jersey in the concession stands or otherwise market his redemption. And finally, winning sure wouldn't hurt. Sadly, the moral outrage of hometown fans is inversely proportional to the success of the team. Would Kobe Bryant, he and the infamous Colorado sex scandal, have been welcomed back so lustily if the Lakers were still mediocre? Unlikely. Vic's reception will depend on any number of factors, but his performance on those Sunday afternoons might loom largest of all.
John Wertheim is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. His most recent book, it's about tennis, not football. It's called Strokes of Genius. You can send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. About 150 House Democrats were kept late at work in Congress yesterday. They were putting in a little extra time to get up to speed on the health care bill. Joel Achenbach had the story for The Washington Post today. Joel, it's good to have you with us.
Kai, great to be here.
Help me out here. What were these guys doing sitting down in the House basement yesterday?
Very unusual thing for these congresspersons, because normally they get up and give speeches, but they had to sit there and listen. They had to sit in these little folding chairs in the House basement and listen to their staff members tell them what exactly is in this health care reform bill, America's Affordable Health Choices Act. And they had to figure out, well, what is it that we're going to vote on here?
A rarity in Congress, actually figuring out what's in the bill.
The amazing thing is that they couldn't even ask questions for 2.5 hours. They had to just listen. And they could write their questions down on a piece of paper, and then later they went through all the questions one by one. This was a marathon session of about 5 hours, interrupted by a procedural vote at 6:30. But this was, you know, pretty unusual.
Theory being that they're going to have to go home and face their constituents on August recess pretty soon, and those constituents are going to ask some questions, and House members want to have the answers.
Well, not only is there a political component to this, this is a really complicated piece of legislation. They don't want to be accused of voting for something they haven't read. And I think they also genuinely understand it's historic, it's important, they want to get it right.
It went so far as vocabulary cheat sheets and all of this stuff. I mean, they really broke it down.
Well, they had a glossary that was handed out with their little packet at the beginning. But it says, what is actuarial equivalent? What does that mean?
Ooh,
what is
yeah,
adverse selection? What's capitation? You have to know what the FMAP is, all that kind of thing. And so this was like a graduate seminar for some of these folks.
All Democrats, right?
It was the Democratic caucus, yes. It wasn't so much that they excluded the Republicans as it was that this was organized by the Democratic caucus. And not every House member sat through the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the attendance was remarkably good. In the hallway, we were not allowed inside. It was all off the record. But we sat in the hallway and we talked to them when they came out. And the one thing that jumped out at me was just how proud they were that they sat there and listened to their staff for so long.
A teach-in in the basement of the Capitol last night. Joel Achenbach is a staff writer for The Washington Post. He blogs for the paper as well. Joel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
While Congress is getting tutored on health care, the White House has been holding its own informational meetings. Over the past couple of months, President Obama has met with health care groups and executives to talk about what he wants to get done. The pharmaceutical industry has been to the White House, doctors groups, and insurers, of course. The CEO of one of the biggest nonprofit health care systems in the country has been in on those consultations, too, George Halverson of Kaiser Permanente. When we spoke earlier this week, he said the media has mostly missed the point of the White House meetings, that the real discussion this time, behind those closed doors, is about changing the way care is delivered, not really about the cost.
And that's one of the really fascinating things about this wave of reform, because in the Clinton era, people were talking about reconfiguring the care delivery system. This most recent reform has been more heavily about cost savings. And the president has said repeatedly that he wants higher quality care, better care, and wants to get to the right outcome by making care more affordable, by making it better. But the debate has gone off track from that point.
Well, let me pick up on that point for a second. We had, on the day of the president's press conference last week, we had David Leonhard on from the New York Times, and he had written a column about health care and why it's so tough to figure out. And his lead question was, people don't understand what's in it for me. And that's a theme that the president picked up on Wednesday night. So I want to flip that around, and I want to ask you, as a representative of the healthcare industry at large, what's in it for healthcare to get this reform going?
What's in it for healthcare is if we can cover everyone in America, we can do a much better job of taking care of people. Right now, a majority of kids do not get right care for asthma. And because kids have coverage and they lose coverage, they go to a care site, they go to a different care site, there's no feedback from the emergency room to their primary care doctor, there is no consistency in asthma care. And that can't be fixed until the kids have continuous coverage and a continuous database. So if we're really going to fix care, we need everyone covered.
Universal coverage, that's your step one.
Universal coverage. We need coverage for everyone in America.
So how do we get from where we are right now to universal care? How do we do that?
Well, we need to do a couple of things. One of them is we just need to make sure that we expand Medicaid to cover all low-income people, whether or not they're parents. We need to make sure there's intermediate subsidized care for middle-income people. But we just need to make the commitment. Every other industrialized country has done that, and most of them do it with a double mandate. Everyone must buy coverage, and every insurance company must sell it.
Isn't it time, though, perhaps to get our brains around the fact that if we're going to do that at some kind of reasonable cost, then everybody can't have all the care they want?
I don't think that's true at all. I think that the issue is not that we need to ration care. We do not need to ration care. Right now, when you look at diabetes, 32% of the cost of Medicare is diabetes. It's number one cause of blindness, number one cause of amputations, number one cause of kidney failure. And when you look at the care delivery patterns in America, we only get care right for diabetics 8% of the time. If we got care right for diabetics 80% of the time, we'd cut the number of kidney failures in half.
At the end of the day, then, are you hopeful or not that this time around we're going to get some kind of change to the healthcare system done?
I'm extremely hopeful. I'm optimistic. I think there are a lot of people pointing in the right direction. I think we haven't figured out the specifics of what the right direction is yet, and that work needs to be done. It needs to be done quickly, but I'm basically very optimistic.
You've been following the terms of the debate, right? You've been reading what's going on.
Yes, very, very directly.
And you're still optimistic?
And I'm still optimistic.
I have to ask you where that's coming from.
It's coming from a belief that we have to get it right this time.
George Halvorsen, he's the CEO of Kaiser Permanente. Mr. Halvorsen, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show.
You can find a link to the rest of my interview with Mr. Halvorsen and a link to his book on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, protectionism and green power.
The Buy America provision that was in our law certainly opened the door very wide for the Chinese to follow suit.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 11 points today, a tenth of 1%, closed at 9,096. The NASDAQ gained 7 points, a third percent, landed at 1975. The S&P 500 lost 2 points, a quarter of 1%, wrapped up at 979. Sagging earnings reports weighed heavily on the market today. Number 2 business supply retailer Office Depot sank 18%. U.S. Steel dipped 2.2% after its second straight quarterly loss. American Express dropped nearly 2.5% today. Leather goods maker Coach fell 1.3%. Day. Falling crude prices, as we mentioned, and eroding demand turned out the lights on energy shares. Largest U.S. refiner Valero Energy slid 2.4% today. Chevron and ConocoPhillips both spilled 0.75%. Bond prices rose. That nudged the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.68%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. Online at elance.com.
Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its monthly report on durable goods orders, stuff that is supposed to last more than 3 years. The House Foreign Affairs Committee talks about new challenges for international peacekeeping operations. And the Centers for Disease Control focuses on ways to prevent obesity. The conference titled Weight of the Nation concludes tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Time, as the song says, for your letters. We've gotten a pile of them the past couple of weeks. The topic hogging the headlines was healthcare, and so a lot of your comments focused on that, too. We covered the president's visit to the Cleveland Clinic last week. Mr. Obama and others have said it's a model for both quality care and lower costs, a model perhaps the government should follow. Scott Demler, a family physician from Grand Rapids, Michigan, only wishes it was that easy.
The healthcare system is very complex and very personal. Few people who study it and know it well will offer good or simple solutions. If someone says, just do this, you need to ask about all the other downsides of that option. There are bad consequences to every option, including doing nothing.
Nothing is what some would like to do when it comes to digitizing medical records. The president is pushing hard for electronic record keeping. Critics say going digital is complicated and expensive, a privacy risk, too. From Washington, D.C., Susan Simbreck says stop the belly aching.
All other major industries have gone through exactly the same kinds of dilemmas that the medical industry now faces. Yes, there are growing pains, and yes, there are expenses involved. But when you stop and think about it, it's kind of incredible that, one, the medical industry hasn't computerized yet, and two, they're acting like it's a special burden that they alone have to share.
President Obama had his big press conference on, yes, healthcare last week. One thing we looked at was the challenge the president has in convincing taxpayers that reform is really needed. No small problem when a lot of the absolute costs of medical care are hidden. Insurance premiums, for example, being deducted from paychecks before we ever get them. Roald Evanson owns a cleaning company in River Falls, Wisconsin. He says he sees every one of those costs.
For our small business, a high deductible policy is all we can afford. Every doctor visit is out of pocket until the annual $5,500 deductible is met. When we pay these bills, we know exactly what the costs are.
Commentator Robert Reich says the cost of providing health care to the poor should be paid through higher taxes on the rich. Marion Jones from Richmond, Virginia, says that's a fine idea, not the best one, though.
Instead, the rich can and must be won over to this idea through an appeal, quote, not to their humanity, but to their self-love, as Adam Smith wrote over 230 years ago. A health care plan that covers the poorest 20% will function in the self-interest of the rich because it will protect the rich from the diseases of the poor.
Whether you're rich or poor or somewhere in the middle, send us your comments and corrections. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Two days of high-level talks between the U.S. and China wrapped up in Washington today. It's an annual affair called an economic and strategic dialogue. That could mean almost anything, of course, and usually it does. Currency manipulation on the agenda, trade policy, climate change. Those last two, trade policy and climate change, got rolled into one this week amid cries of green energy protectionism. Our China correspondent Scott Tong reports.
China's solar energy ambitions rest on companies like SunTech Power. In the eastern Chinese city of Wuxi, SunTech factory workers spread out giant sheets of solar energy cells. Eventually, they'll be turned into solar panels. SunTech makes lots of panels, enough to make the company's founder, Zheng Rongxi, the seventh richest person in China.
Our aspiration is to become a giant solar energy company.
This $3 billion man wants to grow SunTech into a global energy titan, like British Petroleum or Shell.
It will produce much higher efficient solar panels than all our peer companies at low cost. And apart from that, our scale will continue to grow in the next few years.
Much of that growth will come from the fledgling China market. Billions of dollars are now being spent on renewable energy projects in China, and SunTech was just picked to supply two of them. The problem is clean energy competitors from the U.S. and from Europe complain they're frozen out of all this bidding. And Chairman Xi acknowledges local governments in China tend to favor local contractors.
This is very common in China. They want to grow their local GDP is understandable.
Well, the commonly used term is local protectionism.
Chris Merck used to chair the American Chamber of Commerce in Beijing. He points out that China's $600 billion stimulus package requires that the money be spent on domestic products in most cases.
I think there is a rising level of what you might call buy China feeling in this market.
Western wind power companies are especially miffed. This spring, when China took bids on 25 contracts, Chinese companies won every single one. Earlier this month, U.S. Commerce Secretary Gary Locke said denying multinational companies access to the China market could pose a serious threat to trade cooperation. But there's a problem with Washington's position. The U.S. stimulus has Buy America language, which makes it easy for China to play the I'm rubber, you're glue card. Again, Chris Merck.
The Buy America provision that was in our law certainly opened the door very wide for the Chinese to follow suit.
And for Washington, it will be hard to challenge China. Beijing has yet to ratify an international free trade deal on government purchasing. And if this is protectionism, sustainable development researcher Hu Zhenyu says it's because China is still trying to catch up in green energy.
The U.S. and the European Union are the global leaders in solar and wind power. China's behind in the development of technology, and it's behind in government subsidies.
Maybe so, but there's growing talk of trade friction around the world. And if it gets worse, economists think the countries that get hurt the most may be the ones that export the most, i.e. China. In Wuxi, eastern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today about the perils of social media. Beware how you use Twitter, everybody. A property management company has sued one of its tenants over what it says is a 140-character character defamation. The tenant in question tweeted about mold in her apartment and how the company wasn't doing anything about it. And the legal complaint reads, in part, defendant published the defamatory tweet on Twitter, thereby allowing the tweet to be distributed throughout the world. Kind of makes your head spin, doesn't it? We tweet, too. This program and I do nothing defamatory, though. It's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 11 points, a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq rose 7 points, a third percent. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points, a quarter of 1%. Our producers include Megan Larson, Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time on the radio broadcast, big batteries and sunshine spark energy deals in San Diego.
This is going to be the Kitty Hawk of sustainability over the next 5 years.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.